Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you very, very much. And I'm delighted to be here. I'm delighted to see all of you here as well. But particularly to be in Kilmore, because that was played such an important role in the story of Hamilton Hume, as we will see as I tell you that story. Hamilton Hume was Australia's first native-born hero. As the British settlers confronted an alien landscape and its occupants of 50,000 years, the young bushman led them through the hostile terrain and its fretful custodians to the best grazing land, the finest streams and watercourses. And they rewarded him with celebrity. When Hume set out on a journey to the unknown, it was news. When he returned, they gathered to hear what new wonders he'd discovered and what new pastures they could appropriate. As an Australian-born figure, he occupied a particular place in the society of the day. He and his companions were termed currency, as opposed to the British-born sterling, or alternatively, as white natives, to differentiate them from the black natives that surrounded and threatened their settlements. Mrs. Felton Matthews, the British wife of a surveyor, recorded her views in her 1833 journal when she and her husband passed through the Hume property near Campbelltown. "Mr. Hume," she wrote, "is a native, but decidedly the best informed and most agreeable of any that I have seen. They're usually ignorant, awkward, and vulgar, or else shallow, conceited, and vain." However far he rose through the colonial ranks, he was never able to overcome his nativity. It was even said, correctly, that where other explorers and intruders on Aboriginal tribal land were attacked, Hamilton Hume was able to mix freely with them and to gain their trust. And while this might be accounted a great virtue among his fellow bushmen, it merely confirmed society's judgment of his place in the pecking order. It mattered little that his father was a free settler and his mother, a daughter of the manse, was the matron of the colony's most important girls' orphanage. Moreover, his wife Eliza was also from a respected grazing family, though she too was Australian-born. Indeed, the location of his birth would haunt him through his long life until in its later chapters he would at last strike back. That was when he confronted a representative of the class from which he was forever excluded. And his target was the man with whom his name is inextricably linked to the expedition that more than any other would transform the British penal colony into the nation of today, Captain William Hilton Hovell. The great journey that they and six convicts took in 1824 from the tentative southern reaches of Sydney settlement to the coastline of Port Phillip would totally transform perceptions of Australia. And it was achieved against all the odds. Indeed, it's been called the worst equipped expedition in the history of colonial Australia. But despite the impassable mountains, the wild rivers, the threat of starvation, and the timidity of his and incompetence of his sterling companion, the Australian, the currency lad, got them through. It should be no surprise that his leadership of that epic journey of 1824-25 gave him his greatest pride and satisfaction. So, when word reached him 28 years later that during a visit to Geelong, Hovell, or as he preferred to be called, Hovell, claimed himself to be the man who, in his words, discovered a wilderness which is now a thriving seat of civilization, an infant nation capable of producing food to feed half the world, wool to clothe half the world, and gold to buy half the world, Hume was appalled. And it was not for the first time that Hovell had blown this false note on his own trumpet. But until then, Hume had remained silent. But now he decided he'd had enough. Now it was 1853. Gold had been discovered, and the country was in the process of great change. Now that stifling sense of class imported by the British colonists and which had kept him silent had begun to lose its clout. The country was too big and too hostile to the European way of life for it to survive intact. And the great gold discoveries had put paid to the idea that class was immutable, that wealth and standing were dependent upon birth and ancestry. A single stroke of a miner's pick could turn a humble prospector into a social luminary. So, with his habitual care and thoroughness, Hamilton Hume compiled published a report he entitled A Brief Statement of Facts in Connection with an Overland Expedition from Lake George to Port Phillip. It was a devastating document. It contained supporting letters from three of the convicts who made the journey and who were now respected citizens, from the highly influential pioneer businessman Alexander Berry, and from two of the colony's most celebrated explorers, Charles Sturt and Thomas Mitchell. It revealed that on no fewer than three occasions, usually when they were confronted by rivers, Howell's nerve failed and he pleaded to turn back. And on two of those occasions, he tried to rouse the convicts to mutiny. The last time, when they were only 2 days away from their goal of Australia's southern coast. And if I may, I will read my account of that last occasion, because it occurred right here in Gilmore. Excuse me, I'm still getting over a cold. And a little frog comes into my throat from time to time. On Monday's 13 December in Gilmore, Hume left camp early and scouted ahead. He was relieved that his wounded groin was healing without infection, and he made good progress. He reached a muddy creek and traced its course until he found a ford, then returned to the rest of the party, only to find that once again Hovell had stirred the men to rebellion. Hume was shocked and outraged. They had travelled so far in previously uncharted country. They had surmounted all the obstacles and obstructions nature could place in their way. And now, just when one final effort was required to reach their goal, Hovell had spread such fear among them that they had lost heart. I found a strong disinclination to proceed further, he says in the euphemistic circumlocution of the day. And while I was reasoning with them, Mr. Hovell stood aloof and mute. Hume would not be swayed. Quote, on my map, I pointed out to the men our position, the distance we had come, and how far we had to go. He argued and cajoled. Gradually, he won them round. At last, I came to a compromise with the party. He says that if we had no decided prospect of making the coast within the next 2 or 3 days, I should give up the journey and return with them. Once again, they loaded their gear on the aching shoulders of both man and beast and struggled on. At first, it was hard going. That same day, he says, we crossed the dividing range. But then, being some distance in advance of the party, I observed an opening and a fall of land far to the south. It was not unexpected. This was an area of great Aboriginal significance. It not only possessed a powerful spiritual dimension for the local people, it was a trading hub for the exchange of stone implements. The signs of Aboriginal activity were all around, and for Hume, the topography indicated a natural sloping toward the coast. And that was exactly what he'd been searching for. Thinking the struggle at last won, he says, "My heart rose and I cheered long and loud. Most of the men left their cattle and rushed towards me. Hovel had been trying to fix the perambulator which Claude Bossuet had run against the boulder." The perambulator was what they used to measure the distances. But then he too joined the rush. Hume pointed them to their goal. Even Hovel briefly felt the sense of triumph in the moment. The next day was literally all downhill. Hume said he could see water in the far distance. But then, according to Tom Boyd, Mr. Hovel ridiculed and said it was smoke. The next day, Boyd says, "We came upon a blackfellow's camp with the mud oyster shells lying about it. Mr. Hume pointed out these to Mr. Hovel and asked where they came from. He replied, 'From the sea, of course.' And we made the sea that day." It was 16 December 1824. Hume's document caused a great stir in social circles at the time. But by then, the earlier myth of Hovel's joint leadership had taken root, and the real story of the expedition has been lost until now. For mine is actually the first biography of our greatest explorer to find a commercial publisher. And it was only one of his many feats of exploration. It was Hume, often accompanied by his Aboriginal companion Dewell, who first explored the area from South Sydney to what is now Wollongong, and through some of the roughest country in Australia to Jervis Bay, south to Batemans Bay, then west to Braidwood and the Limestone Plains, the land on which our national capital now resides. It was Hume who led Charles Sturt on his expedition that swept through western New South Wales and discovered the Darling. In fact, despite what our teachers told us at school, Blaxland, Wentworth and Lawson didn't actually cross the Great Divide, and they never claimed to have done so. They reached Mount Blaxland, just over halfway there, before they turned back. It fell to Surveyor Evans to make the final breakthrough, William Cox and his convicts to make a bush track across it, and Hamilton Hume and Thomas Mitchell to forge a route across the Blue Mountains that would open up the west to settlement. Indeed, it was Hume who persuaded the Surveyor General, Mitchell, to order his surveyors to use Aboriginal names for geographical features wherever possible. And the map of Australia is so much the better for it. It was Hume's association with his boyhood friend John Batman that led directly to Batman's establishing the first white settlement on the Yarra that became the Victorian capital. And if this is new to you, it's because we were never taught Australian history in our schools and universities. Instead, we were taught the British history of Australia, which is a very different story. In that world, the Aboriginal people barely existed. The explorers would rather die than seek their assistance and advice. The convicts deserved to be treated like slaves. And of course, the British governors were all paragons of virtue. I don't have to tell this audience that it just isn't so. But you are the exceptions. The myth survives and is still promulgated by a powerful coterie of Anglo-Australians led by two of our recent Prime Ministers, John Howard and Tony Abbott. For reasons best known to themselves, they hang on desperately to a concept of our colonial past that bears very little relationship to reality. Hamilton Hume lived through the first 80 years of our colonial times, so his story has allowed me to paint the larger picture of that extraordinary period. It involves the horrors of the penal colony, the atrocities of the frontier wars, the absolute tumult of the gold rush, the biggest the world had ever seen, the little known or understood bushranger rebellion of the 1850s and 60s, and the growing demands for federation and independence. But for Hume and those native-born Australians like him, it was a love story. They loved the bush, they loved its vastness, they understood and respected it, just as they understood and respected the people Hume called my friends of the forest. I hope and believe that the time has come when all of us who love this great land are ready to take a new look at our past through our uniquely Australian eyes. Perhaps that's the reason the book has been received so well. After only 9 months, it's been reprinted 8 times. I'm delighted and relieved that this is so, and not just for the selfish response of the writer, but because that's the only way that we'll prepare ourselves for the decisions that confront us now and in the future, as we finally come to terms with our place as an independent nation in the Asia-Pacific region. Hume played a vital role in those 8 decades of the Australian story, sometimes at the forefront, sometimes as a bit player, but always engaged in the great adventure that was the making of Australia. But by the 1870s, the tremendous exertions of his early life were taking their toll. And in the second half of 1872, he supervised the construction of his tombstone in the Yass Cemetery, as well as the drafting of his extensive will. His principal concern was with the preservation of his name and the manner in which history would remember him. His extended family held him in the highest regard, but he and his wife Eliza had remained childless, and this added a special poignancy to his disquiet. His fear was well merited. He had named the country's greatest river, the Hume, after his father Andrew, but they had taken that from him and replaced it with the name of George Murray, an obscure and quickly forgotten Scottish politician. This anxiety for recognition was reflected in the epitaph he wrote for his tombstone. It read, "For the sake of those who bear my name, I should wish it to be held in remembrance as that of one who, with small opportunities but limited resources, did what he could for his native land." Hamilton couldn't know that his own name would one day adorn the largest and most fitting memorial imaginable, the great thoroughfare that would come to be known as the Hume Highway. It began in 1830, and the decision to name it after the explorer was taken by the New South Wales government in 1928. It served Australia well during the Second World War, but was only completed as a dual carriageway in 2013. And in 2015, the National Trust agreed to turn the old Hume Highway 31 into a tourist attraction in its own right. So in one way, Hamilton Hume got his wish. But in all the years since his death in 1873, the story of his life had not found a commercial publisher until now. And in so many ways, we are celebrating that today. I truly hope that the old man of the bush can now rest easy. Thank you.